Good morning, church. First Sunday of the new year. The lavishness of God's love and forgiveness at Bethlehem and Golgotha. I asked you last week, and let me ask you again this week. Would you look for God in a manger or on a cross? Last week, we looked at Scripture and discovered that God's love and forgiveness were evident from the very beginning. Very beginning. For in the Garden of Eden, God in judgment said to the devil in Genesis 3:15, it's recorded, I'm going to put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. He's going to crush her head, but you are going to strike his heel. The Old Testament unfolds the plan of God, which becomes clear in God's choice of three key men, Abraham, Moses, and David, whose lives and prophetic ministry coalesce in the person and the life and the ministry of Jesus. After the sin of Adam and Eve, there was judgment on the world, and the Garden of Eden was closed. Just a little later, in Genesis chapter 6, it tells us that the wickedness of man and every inclination of his heart was evil, and God in judgment sent the flood. Genesis 11 tells the story of the Tower of Babel when men sought to reach heaven and make a name for themselves. But judgment followed, and God confused their languages, scattering the people over the face of the earth. And we would expect that with the increase of sin, more judgment would be forthcoming. But no. Genesis chapter 12 tells us that God chose to come down and speak to Abraham, challenge him to leave everything, while also give him a fourfold promise. Have you ever looked at that fourfold promise? Number one, about a people. You're going to be a father to a people and a nation, and eventually, of course, that was going to be the Jewish nation. Number two was the place. I'm going to lead you to a place which eventually, of course, would be the land of Canaan. Number three, there was going to be protection. I'm going to bless you and curse those who curse you, for I'm going to be with you, said God. And fourthly, and importantly, there was a program. Through you, all the world is going to be blessed. The promise from God to Abraham was later fulfilled in the birth of the Jewish nation as the people of God. But also, through his continuing seed, Jesus was born. All children of God can trace their heritage back to Abraham. No wonder that Abram was called a friend of God in James chapter 2 and verse 23. And the unfolding of God's plan continued with Moses. Moses is also spoken as a friend of God in Exodus 33:11. You know the story in Genesis 37. It tells us how in hatred and envy, Joseph's brother sold him to the traders who sold him in Egypt. And when a great famine arose, the brothers, when in Egypt to buy food, discovered that Joseph was alive and in authority. And Genesis tells us that eventually that Jacob and the whole family of 70 people moved there and were protected thus from the famine. In the years that followed, because of the divine blessing of God, they multiplied greatly, until Pharaoh, afraid of this vast population, made them slaves. And they became Pharaoh's slaves for 350 years in Egypt. Moses was born in Egypt, but in the natural, at a most inappropriate time. Pharaoh had just issued an edict that all the newborn male children were to be thrown into the Nile and drowned. It was an edict programmed to decimate the growth of the Israelites. But you remember the story. First, Moses was saved from death. Secondly, he was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter and educated in the wisdom of Egypt. Thirdly, at about the age of 40, observing the treatment of the Israelites, he killed an Egyptian and buried him in the sand. And when this became known to Pharaoh, Moses, fearing for his life, fled. Fourthly, he fled to Midian, near Mount Sinai, there joined Reuel's family, and settled down, marrying one of his daughters, Zipporah, and they had two sons. And then fifthly, 40 years later, when he was 80, God appeared to him, calling to him from the burning bush, instructing him to return to Egypt to free the Israelites with those compelling words, "Let my people go." But sixthly, the Bible tells us that Moses was very reticent and gave five excuses. "I am not good enough. I don't have all the answers. People won't believe me. And I'm a terrible speaker. And I'm just not qualified." And then he ended his excuses with, "God, send anyone but me." Do you answer that way as God calls you? "God, send anyone but me." God, of course, did send Moses and sent the plagues on Egypt, which probably lasted many months, at least 10 months. And the final plague God was to send was the death of the firstborn. However, the death of the firstborn of every Israelite family would escape if they slaughtered a lamb and put the blood on the top and the sides of the door. God promised that when the death angel flew over the land, if he saw the blood, he would pass over that home and the firstborn would not be slain. You know the scripture in Exodus chapter 12, verse 13. The blood is going to be a sign for you on the houses where you are. "And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt." It was deliverance, indeed, but under the cover of blood. Hebrews teaches us that Jesus was greater than Moses. And so Hebrews tells us again in chapter 3, verses 1 to 3, "Therefore, holy brethren, who share in the heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus, the apostle and high priest whom we confess. He was faithful to the one who appointed him, just as Moses was faithful in all of God's house. But Jesus has been found worthy of greater honor than Moses, just as the builder of the house has greater honor than the house itself. And Jesus, the new Moses, was greater than the one before because he emulated Moses, but he didn't simply liberate the people from the Egyptian bondage because of the blood of a sacrificed lamb. Jesus took his own blood, being greater than Moses, and offered all people forgiveness from sin. It was deliverance from the bondage of sin by Jesus' own blood." No wonder Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7, "For Christ our Passover lamb has been sacrificed." The unfolding of God's divine plan continued with David. The third incident of the call of David, who finally became king over all Israel, through whom the victories of God's people were finally established in the land of Palestine. Saul, the first king of Israel, had chosen not to depend on God, so God sent Samuel to Jesse's house to find a new king. And you remember, God bypassed seven sons and chose the eighth, a shepherd boy, David. But later, Samuel recorded in 2 Samuel 2, 4, and then in 2 Samuel 5, 3, that first Judah and then all Israel anointed David as king over Israel. In the New Testament, however, we have a greater than David. God's promise to David was that his throne would be established forever. Note that little word in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 11 and 12, "forever," which pointed very clearly to the future kingship of Jesus Christ. In the kings that had followed the shepherd boy became King David, few became close to becoming like David. But the hope nurtured through failure and disappointment was that God would yet act in a future in a more glorious way. And many years later, Isaiah would write the Christmas story, which we repeated over and over again a couple of weeks ago. "For unto us a child is born, a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. And he will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establish and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts is going to accomplish this. And thus God, through Abraham, chose a nation, the Jewish people. Through Moses, he delivered that nation from the Egyptian bondage under the cover of blood, and then under the kingship of David, united the 12 tribes of Israel. Everything had culminated in Jesus Christ. The announcement God had made in Eden that God would crush the head of the serpent, the devil, is made clear by the prophetic ministry of three men who were friends of God. For the very moment that sin had entered the world in the Garden of Eden, God had declared, I'm going to destroy the devil and his power totally. And it took place at Golgotha or Calvary. The cost of the sacrifice of the very life of Jesus was displayed in the Garden of Gethsemane or Calvary. Matthew chapter 26 records that as Jesus presided over the final supper, the Last Supper, he spoke twice of his sorrow. Matthew 26, verses 37 and 38 says, he took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And then he said to them, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. The deep sorrow, I think, was triggered by at least two things. One was the agony of what lay ahead of him, which was the cross, for within 24 hours he would be crucified the most cruel death possible. And having died, he would be buried in a borrowed tomb. What lay behind him, however, was what had happened in the upper room. At the final Passover meal, Judas would leave the meal to betray him for 30 pieces of silver. And immediately after the meal was finished, the disciples would begin to argue who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And Peter declared, I'm never going to betray you, Lord. They had totally missed the significance of the meal. Jesus then took them to the Garden of Gethsemane, where he totally surrendered to his Father's will. And Matthew 26, verse 9 records the instance, going a little farther, he fell on his face to the ground and prayed, my Father, if it's possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as thou will. For Jesus, it was the cup of the divine wrath of God against all sin. But for us, it was the cup of divine forgiveness of heaven for our sin. A short time later, very short time later, Jesus hung on the cross and in his final breath declared, it is finished. And immediately, the curtain of the temple was torn from the top to the bottom, signifying that the most holy place that was filled with the very presence of God was now open to all. Isaiah had said hundreds of years before, in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 11, he, Jesus, shall see of the travail or the agony of his soul and shall be satisfied. Oh, the cost of the lavishness of God's love and forgiveness. Remember, Paul writes in Colossians, Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. Soak for a moment this Sunday morning in the lavishness of God's great love and forgiveness, made so clear in God's judgment of sin in the Garden of Eden, and so clearly portrayed in the lives of Abraham and Moses and David that culminated in the death of God's own Son. God's love and forgiveness cost him the very life of the Son of God. Will you allow this truth to totally grip your heart and life? For if you do, it will change everything in the new year of 2021. Bow with me in benediction. Now the Lord, who did not even hold back his own Son, but handed him over for us, provide you with every good thing you need in order to do his will and doing you what pleases him.